And then you can actually combine Objective-C and C++ into the unholy abomination that is Objective-C++. This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Matt Comey. Matt is the developer half of Big Bucket, where he just released the tactical adventure game Space Age for iPhone and iPad. Hi, Matt.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well. Excited to have the other half. We had Never Mergen on the show a few months ago when Space Age was in its sort of, you know, climax of development and some sort of, the later testing stages. And we were excited to kind of try a beta version of it. But it just came out, was it this past Thursday?
Yep.
And it's been getting some great reviews and a lot of positive. I'm seeing a lot of tweets about it. How does it feel to have it out after what 2.5-3 years of development?
Honestly, it's been nearly four. Yeah, it's very strange. I think we're sort of coming to terms with the fact that it's done. You know, that this isn't this thing that consumes us anymore, right? It's actually something that people can play, and it's bizarre, but it's great and it's a lot of fun. And it's just so awesome to see people, you know, like getting into it, like talking about the story online, and it's like just to have it out there is amazing.
Yeah, that's something that you can definitely get into when you have a project that goes on for that long, that you just get into this almost permanent state that it feels like it will never end, for good and bad. Like, I'm sure you enjoyed working on it, and then now you're kind of not. So
yeah, right.
Although I imagine I've heard some rumblings that a Mac version is coming still, so there's that.
Yeah, that's part of what's... yeah, because to be fair, I am still working on Space Age, and part of that is the Mac build, and part of it's just updates and stuff like that.
Right.
Once you shipped on one platform, though, it doesn't feel as stressful on the other platforms, right? Then it's not trying to get as much as you possibly can done before you ship it. It's just trying to get the platform that's left doing the same thing as the platform you've already shipped.
Yeah, and we know what Space Age is now. You know, it's in terms of what the game comprises, it has a beginning and an end. Whereas before it was out at all, we could always keep adding more to it. So yeah, it's really just getting another platform.
And I imagine you did, right? When you started, you weren't like, let's work on this for 4 years. And, you know, it's probably you build it for a certain amount of time and then you get really excited about it. But then, you know, people give you feedback or you have new ideas or, you know, and things like that. And then that drives, like, you know, it can be better. And you know, especially with indie games, there's often that opportunity to make it better, and so you take that opportunity, and next thing you know, it's 2014.
Yeah, it was very much like, you know, we would sort of find something or some feature sort of made a gameplay mechanic possible, and we just riff on that until we decide, how about we take the game in that direction, you know, and what Space Age, what we thought the game was going to be, it sort of evolved while we were making it based on things that we sort of found to be cooler than our original idea and stuff like that.
Which is a classic way that games evolve, right? Like, you have an idea that's fun, and then the actual game ends up being a neighboring concept of a neighboring concept of a neighboring concept.
Yeah.
Sort of following the fun, so to speak. So that's the way it's made. So for those who don't know, you know, our audience will be a mix of people who have played the game, jumped on it on day one, and people who are not familiar with it. They describe Space Age as a tactical adventure, but the way that I think that gets it across the most, myself having just finished it, the game like 15 minutes before we started recording, is that it has some of those elements of the sort of old school Monkey Island adventure game type games, but with less focus on sort of bizarre combinations of like, oh, you need to put the cat whiskers on the wall in order to make the guard do such and such. Like, you know, it's you know, more of a modern aesthetic as far as sort of you can actually figure out the puzzles. And then also has a tactical element that you can actually have multiple characters and you can kind of control multiple characters in a little bit of like an RTS sort of thing. So melding multiple genres in a way. And then the sort of feeling of it is this retro sort of pixel art aesthetic that Nevin Mergen is so good at, and the whole thing comes together. And then Cable Sasser's beautiful music, it makes for a very cool indie game. So the topic that we have this week is developing games on Apple platforms, which is something that all three of us have opinions about, because we're all to varying degrees, but for the most part, primarily developers on sort of iOS and the Mac. And this has not historically been a platform where games are, most game developers in the world are not thinking, I'm going to make a game just for Apple platforms. They're probably thinking Windows or Xbox or PlayStation as their sort of, or maybe, the Nintendo DS or something like that is their sort of dream platform.
I would say that's not necessarily true anymore. Like, I think there definitely are people now coming into the iOS games with the idea of, I'm going to make a game just for Apple platforms with maybe some, there's always some eye to, maybe I'd want to port to something else later, but, historical Apple and modern Apple are very different in terms of how much they can command exclusives just because the difference in the size of the market, right? That there hasn't been a period for some time where a game could be successful just on the Mac. Like, you had a few games in the early days of the Mac that were first on the Mac just because the Mac had some things that the PC didn't, like guarantee of a mouse. And then basically once the PC caught up, it became the home for those kind of games. And it wasn't really until iOS that Apple had the mind share to draw developer exclusives. But I do feel like now they do, that there's stuff out there that definitely, was Apple focused in the developers' minds when they put it out.
Yeah. And that totally makes sense. I'm still to some degree have remnants of the old way of thinking. I had a Mac in, 99, 2000 on Mac OS 9. But at that time was still into games, and the selection of games that were available at that time that were available ported on the Mac was pretty sparse, let alone sort of Mac exclusives. And obviously iOS has changed that dramatically. Everything from Angry Birds to Flappy Birds, basically all the birds have changed people's perception on that. So Matt, for some context, Space Age is available exclusively on iOS right now. It's coming to the Mac. Your previous game, The Incident, was the same. It was on iOS only. Did it end up coming to the Mac, or is it still iOS specifically?
It's also on the Mac, yeah.
Right. What was the sort of origin behind that as the sort of platform rollout that you go for the games that you work on?
Why Apple exclusive?
Yeah. Like, a lot of folks that would build a game would, if it's successful on iOS, they might go to Android. Whereas, if you build a game that's successful on iOS and so you bring it to the Mac, that has a certain feeling of, being somebody who's focused on Apple platforms rather than necessarily mobile.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's because, to be honest, the main reason for the incident, first of all, I came to iOS, so I came to to Coco and Objective-C through the iPhone, and then I made an app, like a TV guide app called TV Forecast, and then after that, I wanted to make a game, and it was a little puzzle game that I made on my own. It was a again, Objective-C and Coco. And so, these are Apple frameworks and more or less languages. I don't know how portable Objective-C is anymore, but so I really was, I'd committed to the platform as soon as I began, because it was all, there was no, I didn't use any engine. I didn't use, I don't know if there was Unity at the time, but I sort of, because I was part of the you know, I'd sort of sold, I'd bought in to the, to, you know, the app store. And then after a while, now fast forward to the incident, after a while, the incident being out on iPhone and iPad, and they're talking about bringing out the Mac store, it was kind of a no-brainer, you know. And given that I'd already, you know, so much of the frameworks are identical between iOS and OS X, there wasn't too much work involved in the port. Whereas, you know, to take it from Apple's sandbox, I guess, over to Android, I don't even know what's involved. I mean, I don't even think, without using some sort of third-party cross-compiler or an outsourcing to another team, the only way to really take it anywhere other than the Mac next would have been to rewrite it, you know? And I just like Objective-C and Cocoa so much. And I like writing in it, and I like how it looks, and I'm so used to it that, you know, that's where I begin and that's where I'm most comfortable. And Android is interesting, and PC more so for me, I think, just because of what Space Age is. I'd like to see it on the PC, and I just love one day just sort of to have a check it off a bucket list to be able to have a game on a console. But just in terms of what I've got behind me in reuse and experience, it's inside of Apple, you know. So yeah, breaking out of that is a scary idea.
Yeah, it's something that it's been on my mind recently, because over the last couple of weeks, I've been working on this sort of game prototype, which I've been having fun with and subjecting Nigel to beta builds of with janky Game Center support and things like this. And because it's the toolbox that I'm familiar with and comfortable in, building it using Cocoa, and, you know, I actually ended up learning Swift to build it, but it ended up being something that's using UIKit. It's like very much a creature of iOS, because that's what I know and that's what I'm able to prototype quickly with. But it gets to the point, if, you know, we were to look at this and say, you know, this is something that has a lot of potential, we're really excited to keep building it, it's not exactly that appealing to say, oh, well, but what if it ends up being so successful we want to port it to Xbox? Let's rewrite it from scratch in Unity. Like, it's not, you know, yeah. we were, the thing that got me hacking on it at, you know, 1 a.m. on that first night was not because it was using the most cross-platform, lowest common denominator toolkit. It was because I could get it going fast and iterate fast. So I think that sort of platform, you know, what we are familiar with tends to drive that stuff, which is a big win for Apple.
There is something sort of interesting there in the fact that Apple's got these custom, not custom, but, you know, very Apple-centric languages and APIs, but particularly the languages, because games have kind of an interesting thing about them that's different from a lot of other kinds of applications, that games have huge portions of the code base that don't really interact directly with the system toolkit, right? That in games, it's actually fairly straightforward to isolate off some of the bits that care about what the underlying operating system toolkit is. And, you know, you have these huge chunks of code that are just game logic, right? That are sort of pure self-referential only code, that is just, you know, entities in the world talking to other entities in the world. And that actually makes games, you know, in some ways, some of that stuff about particularly the toolkits doesn't matter as much, but so you see things like, you know, like games being done on PlayStation 4 and Xbox One, and, you know, it doesn't cost them double the effort to take a game on the PlayStation 4 and put it on the Xbox One, even though most of the system libraries are extremely different, because probably, you know, at most 10 or 20% of the code in the game is actually platform dependent, and the rest of it's just built on top of a few abstractions and dealing with other objects that are built on top of abstractions and doing that gameplay logic. But Apple's kind of put itself out in the wilderness a little bit by having the language on the platform is something that's very difficult to use in other environments. That there are, you know, there are ways you can get Objective-C going in other places, but it's not really well supported. And with Swift becoming, you know, probably a big thing on Apple platforms over the next few years, I think that's even more of a shame that that stuff isn't more widely usable, because Swift, I think, would actually be a fantastic language to develop games in. That it's got a lot of the things that you want in a language for game development. You know, a lot of Objective-C programmers are kind of annoyed at Swift because they're like, oh, it's just a better C++. But game developers have chosen C++ for very important pragmatic reasons. So for game developers, a better C++ is a really good deal. But you can't really commit to, oh, I'm going to write a big game in Swift, even if it would be better, because you know, it's not available on the platforms that I care about, unless you're willing to say, all right, well, I'm only going to do an iOS and a Mac version.
Well, there's something really interesting. There's a few really interesting things there. One is that it seems strange. So Swift, for anyone who's not an Apple sort of platform developer, is Apple's new programming language that they debuted this past summer. So it's been around 5 or 6 months. So it's pretty young as a programming language, but it has a lot of the characteristics of sort of the faster old school programming languages that doesn't have garbage collection or some of these like automatic things that programming languages do for you that can be slow. And so, yeah, it totally makes it suitable for building things like operating systems and potentially games. But the thing that's sort of weirded me out about it as someone who's like investing in it, especially, you know, as a game that I might on one day maybe want on another platform, is that it's not only that Apple doesn't support Swift on other platforms themselves, it's that Swift isn't open source. So someone out there, like I would probably not invest the time to do this, but you can imagine someone out there being like, oh, you know what, like, you know, EA or some game company deciding we want to port sort of the Swift language runtime so that it runs on Android or it runs on Windows or something like that. But Swift and sort of the C#.NET languages were the sort of two big, or I should say Swift, I shouldn't say Swift, but like sort of Apple's languages and Microsoft's languages were the sort of two main commonly used languages that were not open sourced until like 3 days ago when Microsoft open sourced. They're now open sourcing .NET and C# and their sort of language runtimes, which is leaving Apple like really sort of out in the woods as far as, you know, pushing a new language. And, you know, we can, you know, it's only been around for a few months, so we can only, you know, we can't say they're never going to open source it, but it feels kind of awkward now that they haven't. So if Chris Latner is listening, please open source Swift. But the other interesting thing about it is that sort of aspect that I'd never really thought about it, even though I am building a game in Swift. It's not a performance intensive game. It's a turn-based spy game. So it doesn't really matter. It's not doing many calculations. It's not doing anything really sophisticated that would cause sort of the issues that you see in something like a 3D game. But you build a 3D game in a sort of high level, cool language like Ruby or JavaScript or something. And then just suddenly the language decides, hey, I'm going to do some garbage collection. I'm going to do some cleanup work for you. And then just like you drop 3 frames in a row, which, you know, it might not sound like that big of a deal, but when you're playing a game that's like the end of the world, pull the plug, this language is done. So,
yeah, required garbage collection is way more dangerous in a game environment than I think most non-game programmers realize. Like, you know, certainly you can get away with it, and some, you know, some of the language runtimes do, but even C# and Java, which have incredibly well-tuned garbage collectors that they sunk thousands of hours into, like, what's the most famous Java game out there? Minecraft. And what do people complain constantly about in Minecraft?
Like, performance.
How laggy and pausey and bad performance it is, you know? Like,
And C# is, to be fair, well used in a lot of indie games. Unity is the sort of popular framework that people build with C#. But I've heard from multiple people who've worked on sort of large Unity games that they use the C# stuff to prototype out and get a sense of the game. And when they've locked in, this is exactly what it's going to be like, they end up rewriting stuff in C++, which is cool to be able to do that. But you can actually also do that on the Apple platforms. We did a couple apps that were 3D or other performance intensive stuff that we build it in Objective-C, and then you can actually combine Objective-C and C++ into the unholy abomination that is Objective-C++, which is just some of each, but it allows you to sort of port it in place. And so you can actually say, okay, we're going to port the pathfinding into C++. Okay, we're going to port the sort of model layer to C++, and then the game still runs and is still playable at, you know, on a daily basis. And so you're not just going off on like a 6 months of rewrite, which is pretty much the least pleasant thing you could ever get into in game development. But so Matt, you've been using C++, you've been using Objective-C as a language for game development. How do you feel? Like, you see Swift coming down the pipeline. Are you excited, to potentially jump onto that bandwagon for maybe the next game?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm excited only, insofar as like where things are headed, but, I don't know, really, the way this whole discussion has gone so far describes my approach to it as well, which is it's part of the platform, and it couldn't be any more part of the platform, you know, insofar as it's closed source, like you mentioned. Similarly, we've got, you know, Metal, which isn't just Apple, it's just iOS. Some of these... These things haven't mattered as much before, when the only mobile platform worth discussing in terms of being able to, you know, make a living was Apple. But I don't know how that goes anymore. It's something I need to revise, I guess, just to take another look. But certainly there are a lot of people on other platforms that I want to potentially have playing my games, and Swift is not something that's going to help me to do that. But still, any iOS apps, like my next iOS app will almost certainly maybe be developed in Swift, you know, Swift that isn't necessarily a game, I mean. I don't know. I honestly haven't written anything in it. I see it all the time when I look in the documentation now. But it's still something that's on the horizon for me.
It's still definitely in, I don't want to call it beta because it's not technically beta, but it still has rough edges. You know, I've been working in it in the last few weeks every day. There's lots of Stack Overflow answers, but I still get stuck, like, you know, I was trying to play a sound effect, and it was like, well, that calls into this, you know, fairly obscure API that has not been annotated for Swift very intuitively. And so I'm trying to figure out, it's just saying, giving some obscure error, which is not like, it was actually kind of funny on this particular one. It was like, error, missing parameter, such and such. And I'm like, okay, so I add the parameter. And it's like, error, extra parameter, such and such. And I'm like, it's the same parameter. This dude was just complaining I didn't have it. Also complains if I have it. So it's just like, I got to wrap something in a typer or whatever. But it's still, you know, that's because I'm using a more obscure API. They've been going through and scrubbing the APIs and giving them enough annotation so that they can give useful errors and, you know, be a little more ergonomic. But the issue of sort of being able to have your game be experienced by people on other platforms is an interesting one, because as an example, Mike Bithell, who wrote Thomas Was Alone, which is this sort of famous game where it's like a kind of platformer where you're a rectangle and like walk around, and but it ends up actually being quite sort of an interesting sort of emotional experience of the rectangle, one of well-liked indie games of the last few years. He just had a post yesterday saying that the game is now available on PC, Mac, Linux, PS3, PS4, PS Vita, Xbox One, Wii U, iPhone, iPad, and Android phones and tablets, which to him seems totally ridiculous. And he gets people sort of complaining, like, why are you spending all your time porting to all these? Why are people going to buy 10 copies of your game? Sort of in their mind, everyone knows, everyone's played Thomas Is Alone, this relatively obscure indie game compared to the mainstream. But he's sort of has, and I can link this post in the show notes, but he has this kind of post about, yeah, like, you've heard about it, but it turns out that a lot of people just like have one platform, and like maybe they just play Windows games, and if it's not available on Steam, then it doesn't exist to them. Maybe they only have a Nintendo DS, and that's the only platform that they ever play games on. An interesting thing that he said, which actually to me almost is a bigger argument for it, as far as like a you want a lot of people to experience your game, is that and as a marketing perspective, is that every time he released on another platform, it he could see the spike in sales on every other platform. So if it was like Thomas Alone is now available on Linux, then PS4 sales would go up, which is interesting. But it's just like, hey, it's a thing for the press to talk about. It's a thing for people to be like, oh, you know what, I should. And the crazy thing about it is that I was like, hey, you know what, I should replay that game. Like it triggers that. Like when you get exposed to the game doing a new thing, it makes you want to play it, whether you've played it before or have been considering playing it, or, you know, because people hear about something two or three times. So it's an interesting argument for porting. It can actually cause sales on your previous platforms, which is kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah, I remember when Sword and Sorcery came out on the Mac, even though I'd finished it, I bought it anyway just because I wanted to play it on the Mac.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, and there definitely are people who will buy games on... I've definitely bought a game on a second platform, although more often because I was annoyed that once I started playing it, I'm like, oh, yeah, this should actually be... I should be playing this on a TV and not on my phone or something, you know?
There is also the flip side of games that are single platform are often just better because they take advantage of the platform's strengths and characteristics and stuff like that, right? If you look at the console market, like a lot of the games that have just been like the real system sellers for the platforms have been exclusives because those developers are sinking all that time into making sure that they've made the right trade-offs for that platform and that they're using all the tools on that platform to the utmost. And, you know, that's not quite the same sort of marketing, but quality can turn into marketing as well. If you can make a better game by saying, yeah, we're going to only go on iOS because we can get Metal on iOS and none of the other touch platforms have graphics that's that fast. And we're going to make our game touch focused. And so it's got to be on a tablet and we're not going to try and do some half-assed mouse and keyboard or gamepad interface for it. Then, you know, you can, in theory, make a game that's better. And certainly there's lots of examples of that in the console space. Like I said, I mean, just, you know, lots of big name titles, like all the Naughty Dog games are all PS3 and their upcoming ones will be PS4 exclusive. And those are, you know, way better than a lot of the other games that are cross-platform. I don't know that the platforms that are lagging behind the state of the art, like iOS, are necessarily going to get those same kind of exclusives, because no matter how much you metal things up on iOS, you're going to be able to beat Android, but you're not going to be able to beat a PS4, right? So you're kind of on your back feet already in terms of really blowing stuff away by using the features of the platform well. But it's definitely something to consider that reaching for the quality bar by going single platform exclusive can gain you some credibility and some marketing muscle as well.
Well, there's some good examples of this. Like, look at Letterpress. Letterpress was a game, actually, that was like an iOS 7 game before iOS 7 came out. It had that sort of white and flat and colorful feel. And it was from Lauren Brichter, who's a, you know, well-loved iOS developer focused, you know, he'd worked at Apple. He'd sort of focused on the platform and understood the platform really well. It's one of the first games to integrate Game Center. And like specific sort of iOS platform technologies. And even though apparently he prototyped it in UIKit and then decided, you know what, I'm going to build this using OpenGL and rebuild UIKit from scratch because he's crazy. But it still was so much a sort of Apple platform game that it ended up helping a lot in the marketing as far as people who are in the sort of Apple scene, Apple developers, Apple writers and stuff like that, really promoted the game a lot. And it ended up sort of, like you say, Nigel, the quality ended up being sort of a marketing piece. Like, hey, this is like a simple game that's done really, really thoughtfully. So it's going to kind of talk to the aesthetics of that platform, which I think ended up being a good move. I don't think he ever ended up porting it to Android or anything. I think it was, you know, quite successful in its niche. And it's actually a related thing to that, which is that if you integrate with the platform, you get all the benefits of that, those things for free, but then, you know, sort of can't necessarily break out of that box. So one of the things that was in Letterpress that also we've sort of been playing with this game prototype that I've been working on is Game Center, which is Apple's sort of multiplayer and achievements and challenges thing, sort of equivalent to Xbox Live or sort of, I guess, Steam, some parts of Steam, which, you know, it's fine. It does what it needs to do, and it does it for you, and you don't need to run some server that runs matchmaking and stuff like that. But it means that if you're like, hey, I want to bring this game to Android, then you need to find a replacement for that, and then people are going to be confused or annoyed why they can't play against their friend who has an Android phone, assuming you're the sort of person that would be friends with someone who has an Android phone.
Yeah, there's also, I remember now, with the incident, we actually had part of GameKit was the ability to sort of play in a local network, and I used that to make a connection between, at the time, for hardware requirement, just in terms of performance, it would make a connection between an iPad and an iPhone, and that way you could use your iPhone as a controller. So you weren't playing against somebody, but there was a connection formed between two devices, and then you could use VGA cable or whatever to connect your iPad to the TV. And yeah, so it was definitely buying into the whole Apple framework or whatever the word is, the environment.
The platform.
Yeah, the platform, right. But yeah, it was, I think that definitely got a lot of Apple attention insofar as this is an Apple game. And, it wasn't pushing the boundaries of the platform in the way that you would with, a PS4. Like it certainly can't compete in that sort of way, but nor can we as an indie games company. You know, we don't make 3D games because we can't make 3D games. So really we just do the best at what we are capable of, you know. Not to say we can't make 3D, but 3D insofar as what people think when they think that, which is, you know, Call of Duty style. And so, yeah, this low poly or retro 8-bit kind of thing, that's where we can excel. And and I think that's what the iPhone is good at and what the iPad's good at and so on. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know. It's just, I guess the point I'm trying to make is that the mobile platforms can kind of shine in ways that aren't based on how fast they are, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, look at Monument Valley and these sort of things. Even when you are doing a 3D game, they're not differentiating based on frame rate or the crazy particle effects or whatever. They're differentiating based on sort of art and thought and sort of the mechanics and novelty and all these sort of things. And so by being a good citizen on the platform, it launched iOS only. It's now on Android, I believe, but it launched on iOS and only. And you know, like Letterpress and Space Age and these other games that are good citizens on Apple's platforms, they promote it. It's on the App Store. There's this big, cool Space Age banner with the high fidelity art and things like that. And I don't have any numbers as to how well the initial launch day sales were, but I imagine it probably didn't hurt having a big banner on the App Store.
Yeah.
The Game Center aspect of things is particularly interesting because there's a couple of ways that eases things for game developers in ways that's hard for small game developers to achieve, that it lets you tie into the account system, basically, that Apple's already got, right? That you don't need to worry about maintaining some sort of identity thing yourself. You tie into an Apple identity. And in the case of a turn-based game, you don't even need your own servers, right? You can just make a turn-based game that's essentially piggybacking off Apple's infrastructure. And for a small game dev, like, that could be huge, right? That if you had to build a server to do even the sort of simple stuff that something like Letterpress is, now your bar of profitability is a lot higher, and your bar of profitability needs to be ongoing, right? Like something like Letterpress, like I'm sure it probably still sells pretty well, but I doubt it sells as good now as it did the first few months it was out there. And I imagine that if it had sold at its entire lifetime for what it's selling for now, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if it, you know, if it wouldn't be profitable even as a game without that sort of ongoing load. And if you had to run servers for that all the time, and now it's, you know, now it's down to the background noise level of purchase of like, yeah, you know, people are buying it and you're making, you know, few thousands or few tens of thousands of dollars a month. But if you've got to run the entire matchmaking service and game state transmission server, you know, that money's not going to go very far.
Yeah. And that's definitely something that, you know, excites me about the Game Center thing. And it's sort of frustrating, you know, my best friend does actually use Android. So the idea of being able to play the game that I made with him is appealing. But the idea of maintaining a server, and I'm sure there's existing servers, and like having a server that can take turn-based matches and send them, like, and it's really, it's not that much work, and it's definitely not hard. But it's something that, you know, actually has a fair number of moving parts, and then you need to keep it running. And that, in some ways, most importantly, especially if you make a game that is only multiplayer, which is, you know, what Letterpress is, that if you sell that game to somebody, they're going to expect it to keep working, and you don't want it to be like, you know, these scandalous things on, you know, EA games that were maybe not that successful, and they're shutting down, like, you know, some NBA game from 2012 that, you know, a bunch of people are still playing, but not enough for their numbers to justify keeping the servers running. And that's just kind of an unpleasant place to be.
Yeah, and another thing you get for free, similar to things like Game Center and whatnot, is, you know, iCloud, just being able to sync state between devices and whatnot.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm really happy that more and more games are starting to just keep save game state in iCloud, so that when, you know, not just when you restore, but if you like get a new device or switch from playing something to your, you know, from your phone to your iPad or whatever, that the game states just there. Like, there's, you know, there's certain games that I had to sort of pick a platform that I was going to play them on early in, you know, early in starting the game, and just say like, yeah, I'm only ever going to play this on my iPad, even though it'd be fine to play it on my iPhone. Like, the game state just isn't going to be there if I bounce back and forth between them. And I think the game's going to be enough nicer on the iPad that I'm willing to give up ever playing this game on my phone, because the state's not going to sync. I'm going to have to play the game twice in order to have everything fully unlocked or whatever.
That's one kind of cool thing about Game Center, is that across multiple devices, if you're logged in, you'll just get the state of the game in whatever state it is. And so it just pulls and like, here's the matches that you're in, and you just download, you get to save 64 kilobytes of world data, and then you just restore it, and then what each platform does, whatever it does with it. So I believe also on the Mac, you'll get the same sort of data dump, and as long as you can read that, then you can just pick up wherever you are, which is kind of nice, assuming it works. I've been implementing it, and there's a lot of delegates, and if you miss one, then weird things happen. So Matt, you've mentioned that you build your own engines. You built your own engine for the Incident, and I assume a different engine for Space Age, because they're not very similar in gameplay. Is there anything interesting that you sort of learned in your process of building now a four-year game engine?
Only insofar as how it sort of influences the game that you're making, you know, because we had an idea for what Space Age was going to be. And then as I implemented features and realized what other features I could easily implement similar to the one that we had originally planned, then it takes us into new gameplay directions, you know? So I guess there was also, I guess, you know, because Space Age kind of began its life as what we thought was going to be a real-time strategy, you know, and meaning you wouldn't have a small group of players, of characters. You'd have teams, and there'd be green guys and purple guys and, you know, and this kind of thing. So they didn't have personalities of their own. They didn't have names. And so it was based on there being... So the engine was based on there being this group of units, you know, so group one, and then you'd have group two and group three, and then the mission definitions would say things like group when unit in group one stands on tile two, you know, tile in group two, you know, these sorts of things. So the engine, when I say engine in this context, I mean, I usually break it into two, which is there's the bottom half or the inner half, however you like to imagine it, which is things like graphics and sound. And then there's the outer one, which is has a lot more of the game context involved, you know. So that's the outer shell, or the top half knows more about the fact that there are units and tiles and missions and campaigns and whatnot. And so as I'm putting these pieces together, I'm realizing, you know, we could do something a little interesting here. You know, we could have them using items. So I could have an item group. And then once I've got this context of groups, you know, there's groups of tiles, groups of units, groups of what else? Text, you know, like even the lines of dialogues, indexed entries in a list of text. I go, well, how about I make a new list of particles, you know? And so there's this list of particle systems where I can say things like when a unit in group one stands in tile three, start emitting particles in particle system four, you know, these interactions, the system is what I'm trying to say. As the system is sort of elaborated on, the game can kind of develop around it. And I guess, to be honest, this is why it took 4 years. It's because we just kept expanding and diverting and just elaborating on the original idea, which was ultimately, I guess, a story, and then making a game that could best tell that story. I don't know. It's definitely something that I have a hard time separating in terms of describing the engine or the framework or the game logic or the missions or the story. It's all sort of one big thing, you know? The code itself, I like to think, is fairly well broken down. Like, my next game, I would definitely take the bottom section of it, you know, the thing that can take graphics and put them on the screen and play sound and just maintain things like, you know, orientation changes and all that sort of stuff, all the good stuff that is just boilerplate ultimately when you're starting any project. I would take that and use that again. But the stuff that powers Space Age specifically, that, you know, unfortunately is probably never going to get used again. But as far as anything in particular, I don't know. I hope there's enough fun stuff in there to sort of answer your question.
No, for sure. And that's a pretty common thing, that, you know, the game evolved as you're building the engine and new abilities come in. Like, oh, actually, we can do this. But it's interesting to hear that the evolution of it came as, okay, this is an RTS type game, but then over time it ended up being adding more features where the current player could have more detailed, you know, interactions with their environment and, you know, items and stuff like that. Because when you play the game, not getting into spoilers necessarily, although we said RTS, like, to me it was almost like it definitely was a interesting moment when it's like, oh, I can control multiple people at this point, right? Because at the beginning of the game, doesn't spoil anything to say, it starts off as one guy who's walking around, and then you can pick up items and stuff like that. And so it, in my sort of naive view of the game, things were programmed in the order that you counter them in the game, which of course is not not reflective of reality.
Well, that far, what you just described, up until the point where you pick up an item, because items came quite late on. But yeah, the first three missions were built basically in the order that the features became available. So, you know, you learn how to walk, you learn how to pan, you learn that you control multiple units, and then quite a while later, you learn how to use items and the fact that you don't just, you know, there's green team and then there's gold team. You control green and so on. And but then, you know, inventory came much later, and being able to show items to other people and being able to use items with other things and all that sort of came later, and we reinserted them, those features back into the already, you know, completed levels, just made them more complicated.
Yeah. So how much then was that process? So two questions, I guess one flows from the other. Was the level design sort of Nevin's domain as the sort of person who's doing the art and a lot of the writing, or was it sort of a collaborative process throughout the whole thing?
We definitely settled on a process, and it was we would discuss the mission, you know, over FaceTime or Skype or whatever, typically FaceTime, I think. And, you know, we just say, what part of the story is this going to address? What's the puzzle going to be, or what are the puzzles going to be? And then what artwork do we need that we don't already have? Because, you know, it's tile-based. So I think we started with the grass tiles, the clay tiles, the trees. And then, yeah, so let's just pretend we're at that stage. So the editor had that as a palette, you know, the being able to place, you know, dirt and grass and whatnot. And then if a mission required a, you know, a computer, then after Nevin and I finished, you know, our discussion about what the mission was, he would go ahead and draw those items, you know, their on states, the off state, that sort of thing. And then I would implement the mission. So I made an editor for building the missions. I'd place it all down on the map, and then I'd hook up all the rules so that you could play it. And then typically once we had a few plays through, you know, Nevin would go in and he'd change it as well. And he added rules as well himself. I mostly would do the first pass, and then he would come in and make tweaks and whatnot. And then, cause to be honest, it was fairly, what would be the word to describe it? It was a strange editor. It was definitely written very low to the, so, you know, you've kind of got how it's implemented, and then you've got how the UI works on top of that implementation. And you typically want to not expose the implementation when it's unnecessary to do so. You know, you want the editor sometimes to take care of some of the grunt work, but the editor didn't take care of any of the grunt work. You know, so if you were to draw a square of grass, like you've got your dirt floor and you want to draw a square of grass, you would have to pick the top left grass corner, now the top piece of grass, now the top right piece of grass, you know, and you wanted to draw a 9 tiles, you'd have to scroll through the list of tiles and find the exact 9 tiles you need.
Tile top right, tile top middle, tile top right.
Yeah, you know, and then, you know, I want that to be 1 wider. Oh, well, you know, so it's kind of, typically you would just erase it and do it again. It wasn't fantastic. And any ideas I have of maybe releasing it one day are really imaginary. Like if I were to ever have any public release of it, it'd be a rewrite entirely. But anyway, so to continue on with the process, the next step, once we're both happy with it, is I would place in all of the placeholder dialogue. So, you know, we know that Goldman says something to Private regarding what the objective of the mission is. And then we say, you know, so that the placeholder might have square bracket Goldman tells Private what he has to do, close square bracket, and then close square bracket Private says he's hesitant about the objective, you know, this sort of thing. And the square bracket, the editor knows to highlight it red so that Nevin can go into the editor, find the highlighted red text and replace it with actual dialogue. And that's pretty much how we did it. It was start to finish like that. Once we were in a good routine, they pretty much, we churned them out in that way.
So after all of that, like, especially, you know, having spent however many years with an editor that was, you know, fairly, you know, not Stone Age, but like a
rudimentary
Bronze Age,
yeah,
Iron Age.
Yeah.
Does that make you think then that, you know, some of these middleware like Unity and things like that, because that's the thing that it, you know, makes me the most think about, you know, not that I'm working on anything that does have level building really right now, but that's the thing that I would be the most hesitant to give up from having some sort of existing toolkit framework or whatever is the ability to say like, all right, artists, here's a thing, load it all in. And them to have like relatively sophisticated tools for that, because, you know, as you know, building those editors from scratch is a hard thing to justify spending a lot of time on. But on the other hand, it's a sort of multiplier for the productivity of the team when you do that. So it's kind of a tricky trade-off.
Yeah, and I hate fighting against the tools as well.
How much of a multiplier it is also depends on what your team is, right? That if you have a programmer assembling the levels, then you can get away with a lot more than if it's someone who doesn't have programming ability, because you can just say like, yep, to add this behavior, you know, write this code. And for an artist is going to be way less productive doing something like that than a programmer is, but a programmer may be more productive doing that than using a tool, even a sophisticated tool.
Yeah, there's always this boundary line in between what do you have the designers doing, what do you have the developers doing. That, and you know, we talked about a little bit with Jeff LaMarche when we were talking about his transition from Unity, which is the sort of indie approved 3D toolkit, to Unreal, which is the serious business 3D toolkit. And to him, a lot of it was that the artists and stuff could plug in just way more sophisticated stuff on their own without them to be like, Jeff, implement this thing. Jeff, implement this thing. And so often those, you know, sort of code things were really content, right? You know, in the sort of ideal world, you can, even if you're the developer, you can be specifying content in a sort of user interface, like a SimCity sort of thing, a drag and selector. Maybe now the better thing for level design would be like The Sims, right? Like, okay, I'm going to put some rug, and then you just like select and drag a square, and then the little tassels on the outside of the rug, not in the middle of the rug. But that's easy to say. Oh yeah, it would be nice to have a level editor like that. But you know, I'm sure there have been games that have died on the spear of, oh, we're going to make the world's best level editor where you can create everything, and then 2 years later they've created a level editor and have no game. So you don't.
Yeah, but I mean, if we knew what the game was in advance, then we'd know what the editor should look like and what it should do. But the editor had to evolve with the game that we were making, so it kind of all went hand in hand that way.
Yeah,
it's sort of the same trade-off as the Apple platform stuff that we were talking about earlier. Is fundamentally, if you pull in a bunch of technology, whether it's a game engine that you've licensed or a particular platform vendor that you're committing to using their stuff deeply rather than abstracting it or rather than supporting other models, you get a bunch of stuff for free, but the price is that there's certain things that are now hard to do and directions that it's hard to evolve your game into. Whereas if you say, I'm going to toss it all out and write it from scratch, and that can kind of become whatever you want it to, and you know every bit of how things work and where all the knobs and dials are and can change it on any level, but it takes you more time to build that, and you have to kind of pick your battles. Am I going to do an engine versus writing stuff myself? Am I going to use Game Center versus rolling my own networking? Like it's kind of the same trade-off, right?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right.
And good luck to everyone out there making those trade-offs.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thanks a lot, Matt. How can people find more about what you're up to? What's next?
And yeah.
How can they find out what that'll be?
Yeah, well, there's bigbucketsoftware.com. And I'm actually surprised that was the first one I went to. That is supposed to be our place on the web to find that sort of thing out, but it really needs a bit of a paint job. But until that happens, there's also me on Twitter. That's Matt Comey, and that's Comi is my surname. And the Space Age itself, I guess, is something, if anyone hasn't checked that out yet, that's Space Age App on Twitter and spaceageapp.com. And as far as what's next, yeah, I wouldn't hold your breath for that just yet, but there's still some more Space Age stuff in the pipeline.
Gotta get the PS4 port of Space Age done first.
Right, and PS3 and Xbox One and Nintendo DS.
Yeah, no worries. Just start churning them out for sure.
It'll be great. So everybody go check out Space Age on the App Store. We always want to know what you think about the show. So you can visit upup.fm You can send us an email. You can leave us a review on iTunes and let us know what could be better. Seth, thanks a lot for listening, and see you next week.
Are we going to complain about this bullshit with the Monument Valley in-app purchase stuff at all?
Yeah.
Or have we just pre-complained about that so much that everyone knows how we feel about it and can just write the rants themselves?
So this is the thing of, so Monument Valley, wonderful game, beautiful piece of art, really. And we had Ken Wong, who is the sort of lead artist on it, on the show some months ago when the game first came out. And the biggest demand everyone asked for was more levels. We would love to have more levels. This game was so great, but, you know, it takes so long to make the levels that there was only, you know, a certain number of them in the original game. And so they have spent the last months making more levels, and they released them for only $1.99 for additional levels to the game. And they had a horde of people rating them one star with angry messages saying just things, ridiculous complaints like, what, you know, levels should be free. What are they doing? Like, Clash of Clans is free. I don't know why this isn't. And just ridiculous things. Well, it made me very sad.
It makes me want, like, a control in iTunes Connect where you can just blacklist a particular user. Like, just, like, you can look through the Monument Valley reviews and, like, click on their names and be like, I don't want my game to appear to this user ever.
Yeah, well, yeah, definitely. I don't want your $1.99 for, so that you can, you know. And the thing is, like, the new levels will only cost half the cost of the initial game, right? So the people who have the game spent the, you know, $3.99 for the initial game. Like, this is not people who are incapable of, because there's certain people who just, they never want to spend money in a game, and that's fine. That's their prerogative, and that's fine. And if they can't spend money on it, then they can't leave a review on it, and that's fine. But the idea of people leaving one-star reviews on an update, and I think, like, most of them were not saying, I tried this in-app purchase that they added, and it was, I didn't get value for their money. They're saying, I'm angry that they gave me the option of paying $2 for more.
You know, I'm surprised, though, that those are the same people who at the same time are willing to spend $4 or $5 on a game in the first place.
Yeah, it's weird that there's an overlap in between those two things. I don't know. And thankfully, you know, Twitter and the internet came to the rescue and saved their star rating. There was a, you know, campaign to give them appropriate star ratings, and then they got you know, recovered in the sort of rankings. But it's, I don't know. I sort of feel like that it's an inevitable tide that a lot of the money on the App Store is going to be made by free games within app purchase. But when I see games like Monument Valley and Space Age and things like that, that do, you actually do have to pay to play them, I feel sort of aligned with, like, that's my team. And I want that team to go well, the team of people who make games and then that are good and then charge money for them, and to see them insulted by people that are, you know, saying, I bought the game, but I'm just angry that you let me pay more if I want. But I'm sure if they added coins, like, oh, you can have a bucket of monument bucks, then they would probably not be.
Yeah. Well, they get to play one level every day unless they spend monument coins.
Yeah, exactly. And then that's just like, well, you don't have to. You know, you
just yeah.
Sit there and grind for, I don't know, however many hours, and then you can finally. People are the worst. And then the other interesting thing that's happened since we last recorded in sort of eye-rolling stuff is Assassin's Creed Unity is apparently the highly anticipated Assassin's Creed game, about as opposite as you can get from sort of Monument Valley and Space Age, but highly anticipated nonetheless. And it was released in time for Christmas, but not apparently complete, according to the reviews, that it's crashing. And my favorite is there's actually, have either of you seen these screenshots of the game where you'll be having a conversation with the character, but their face hasn't loaded?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just eyeballs and teeth. And it's just so amazingly bad and terrifying. And it's like this happy clown with like no face. And, you know.
But it has a gums and teeth.
Yeah, yeah. Which makes it worse. If it was just no head, it would just be kind of weird. But yeah. Because it has no face, but it has gums and eyeballs, it makes it. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, like, that probably stopped me from like going out and buying a PS4 this weekend. Like,
yeah, because you were talking about that being the game that
was going to make you. Was the first game that I was like, okay, this is a game that I really want to play because I've really enjoyed all the previous Assassin's Creed games. I need a PS4 for it. Like, am I going to be able to wait once Unity's out? And I think the correct answer is yes. I'm going to be able to wait because, you know, maybe they'll fix it eventually in a patch. Like, I'm not going to completely give up on the game and be like, all right, that's it. Assassin's Creed series table flip. But yeah, it sounds like they really whiffed this one. Like,
well, so much for that. Have you been playing any games when you haven't been completely overwhelmed with the glow of having launched?
Actually, I don't, the only, so the only games that I play are iOS games, and the only iOS games I play are casual games. And I don't know what that says about me, but that's, I guess, I like making games, and I don't tend to make time to play them, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? As much as I look at some games and go, oh, that looks like something that I could really get sucked into, and therefore I should probably not go anywhere near it. And that's pretty much my unfortunate approach to the whole thing.
So Clash of Clans is your go-to?
No, Threes.
Oh, that's cool. We like Threes. Yes.
Yeah, Threes is awesome.
Yeah. Asher Vollmer, who was the developer on that, was on the show, and we got to talk at length about it's interesting, definitely, as one of those sort of boil down a game to sort of as simple as it can be, but no simpler. So,
yeah.
Yeah. When I hear casual game, I think free game with, you know, grinding and
oh, no. Pay no, to I hope wait. I hope I didn't insult anybody with that.
No.
Yeah. I just mean the kind of game that I guess doesn't, that isn't really what you would say a niche kind of, doesn't, you know, it's kind of something anybody could pick up. Because, you know, I like to think, I think something like Space Age, it's like, we know in advance, this, it's not for everyone. And, you know, I like the idea of making games for everyone, but Space Age wasn't supposed to be one of those.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting trade-off. And having that discussion with Asher, and, like, he definitely had that in mind, apparently, in building Threes, and wanting something that, you know, kind of anyone can play, and that obviously builds a lot into the incredible success that you have with some, you know, a game like Letterpress. I'm not sure if Lauren Brichter was thinking, yeah, I'm going to build a game that's going to be a smash sensation because everyone likes word games. It's probably more like, hey, I like word games. This could be fun. It seems, you know, like something that's an approachable scope for a game I could make. But those are often the ones, they're sort of the cross-genre hits that folks like ourselves who are sort of into indie games and into the Apple scene are like, okay, yeah, I get this. This is cool. But then also that sort of press and attention goes way beyond to just, you know, folks that are not even necessarily into games, but will download apps and will play games, finding them and getting a lot of enjoyment out of them. So
yeah, and Threes almost feels like, almost like the classic definition of game. Like, you know, it wasn't just a matter of making it fun. They also had to come up with a system, like a very solid set of rules that are not just, internally consistent, I guess, you know, that there are no hacks to Threes, but also that people can understand, you know, because I do remember first looking at it and going, hey, well, what's this? Combined two and one, and then every, you know, like at first I was, I don't understand. And then once you get it, it's just, this is incredible. Like, how did anyone even start to think of this? It's amazing.
Yeah, there's definitely a big uphill battle to kind of distilling down that system that is balanced, and it's challenging but not so hard that you can't make sense of it, and that has a difficulty curve and all the sort of things you want out of a small enough set of rules that people can understand it. And that's, you know, unfortunately, the fact that that's so hard is why the successful thing tends to be copy a game that someone else has done, because then you know how it's supposed to work, and then, you know, it's a lot more efficient on your time. But I think you know, the evidence is out there that, you know, from the Incident and Space Age, that you like to explore games that have not exactly been done as far as their genre and their format. So,
yeah. Yeah, it is funny that, because, you know, I think we approach it as a, let's make a game that's, you know, modeled on some other game, and then just through the implementation of it, it moves from that, just because why would you bring out a game that is ultimately already out there, you know? So, yeah.
It depends to some degree on what the genre of the game is, right? That there's a big difference between saying, all right, there's, you know, there's a game like Threes where they found this very simple, like really polished, really slick mechanic. And by copying the game, you know, you're kind of taking everything that the game's got. Whereas, like, looking at the success of Call of Duty and saying, hey, I'm gonna make a game where, like, you're a soldier and you're running around shooting people, like, you're not taking as much.
That's a great idea, right? We should make a game like that.
the fundamental mechanic there has so much more to give in terms of enemy variety and storyline and, like, all these things that you can do differently, whereas, you know, in a puzzle game, kind of the central mechanic is a lot of times all that the games have got, you know, like that's the unique jewel about them, is the mechanic that the designers have come up with.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess with Threes, you could, as an example, you could describe it to somebody without them having seen it, and they would know exactly what it is after you finish describing it. Whereas, I guess part of what makes Call of Duty Call of Duty is that you have to see it, you know, because if you just said it was a game where you shoot, you go around shooting, it's like, oh, I've seen that before, but you haven't seen it this way. You know, it's, yeah.
Yeah,
it's,
well, and the same with something, anything like Space Age or Call of Duty, which is weird that any list could contain those two games, but that has a story, then, you know, the story itself, if it's interesting, is, and the sort of surprises, which is something that, you know, you can be surprised an arbitrary number of times, but it requires new surprises. And so you can have 100 great games in various genres, and if it's the surprises that you're enjoying, and sort of the novelty and the interesting new experiences, then the game mechanics don't necessarily need to change that much in order to create new surprises. So,